Hi, welcome to Colonial Williamsburg, past and present on history.org. This is Behind the Scenes, where you meet the people who work here. That's my job. I'm Lloyd Dobbins, and mostly I ask questions. The newest building in 50 years on Duke of Gloucester Street will be a very old one. Charlton's Coffee House will rise from the same footings that supported it hundreds of years ago. Architectural historian Ed Chappell returns to the program to tell us more. Will it be exactly the same, so far as you know, as it was when Mr. Charlton was serving coffee and tea?
Well, it'll obviously be as precisely like its predecessor as we can make it, that we can learn. It's a really interesting project. As you say, the site itself is interesting. It's a kind of an inconvenient location in terms of topography. There was a big ravine that ran next to it. And so it was a sort of postage stamp size lot that was partly within the ravine. And so it's only, I think, because it was next to the Capitol, such a convenient site in the sort of ground zero of colonial Virginia, that the coffee house, well, started out as a storehouse and then quickly became a coffee house, was built on that tiny lot.
When we keep talking about rebuilding, but or reconstructing, when are you going to have it done?
Well, it's going to move quite quickly. We've already started to take down some of the 1890s brick in quest of understanding of how the 1749-50 brick was arranged. We found the outline of the original wooden sills. One thing I should say is that the Victorian house itself, the Carrie Payton Armstead house, which sat on the site from the 1890s until about 8 years ago, was not demolished. It was moved down to Gloucester Street, one of the more dramatic architectural events of late 20th century. Williamsburg was to see this great two-and-a-half-story house move the length of Duke of Gloucester Street and take up another location on Henry Street. So that was moved away. We've done archaeology over much of the site. There's other archaeology underway right now on the west side, where we're finding that the grade changed dramatically. There was a substantial retaining wall that tried to address the uneven topography in building the coffee house. So we are gingerly taking apart the 1890s foundations, finding that much of those are built from a brick of the mid 18th century house, and looking for evidence for where the cellar windows were, any evidence that we can find for the central chimney that we think served a cooking fireplace in the cellar and heating fireplaces above. So we think that the drinks and food were prepared in the cellar, dirt-floored cook room in a relatively dark cellar, carried up winding stairs through a little passage and into one room that was for the sort of general gentry, if you will, and then a slightly smaller room to the east that was more private space. Mm-hmm. So it was like one of the rooms at the Weatherburn Tavern, say, that a gentry patron could rent for a private party.
I read the dimensions of the coffee house, and once it's reconstructed, that's not a big building on the inside.
Well, we think it had three rooms on the first floor, two in the front, a single one in the rear, and a pair of stairways. It was slightly smaller than the Victorian house. It's really a very interesting story that this storehouse was built, we know, in 1749 to 50. It survived into the 19th century with some alterations, but it survived into the era of photography. So we've got one or two very hazy photos of Duke of Gloucester Street that capture the front of the building. Then about 1890, it was torn down to the foundations. Two of the walls, the east wall and the south wall, were largely demolished, and the and the building was lengthened a bit. So the Victorian house that was put on those kind of resuscitated foundations was slightly longer than the coffee house. Luckily for us, the builders of the Victorian house not only left substantial parts of the foundations intact, 1749 to 50 brickwork, but they chopped up pieces of the mid-18th century building and used them as furring strips and as framing for a variety of purposes in the Victorian house. So there's a remarkable amount of data in these tiny fragments that survived in the Victorian house.
Now, the coffee house, I read, had a front porch that opened onto Duke of Gloucester Street, and the politicians and lawyers and movers and shakers used to sit out there and have their coffee on pleasant days. Do you plan to put the front porch back on it?
Absolutely. There are a limited number of truly intimate glimpses into everyday activity or extraordinary activity in the town. But one of those sort of wonderful glimpses into the mid-18th century is Governor Francis Fauquier's description of an incident in front of the coffee house and on the porch. He wrote to Whitehall, wrote to London, and reported that the seller of stamps, of basically a tax stamps, was pursued down Duke of Gloucester Street by essentially an angry mob, and that he, Fauquier, was seated on the porch of the coffee house with some members of the governor's council. He said, "The coffee house to which I sometimes go," essentially. So he and other elite members of the Virginia government were on the porch, and Mercer approached the porch sort of in hope of salvation. Fauquier, in his own description at least, played a rather heroic role, that he stepped forward, sort of spread out his arms and turned back the crowd and insisted that they disband, which they eventually did, and Mercer came onto the porch. You know, I think the porch is one of the interesting parts of the story, that if particularly as we talk about the American Revolution in Virginia and the events that led up to it, the background to the revolution, the Stamp Act crisis, and how that played out in the town of Williamsburg is nicely illustrated by the coffee house.
For some reason, in my head, Englishmen would have gone, or descendants of Englishmen, would have gone to the tea house. Mm-hmm. Was coffee a regular beverage in those days in Colonial Williamsburg?
Well, I think the decision to drink hot liquids without alcohol was a development that was focused particularly on genteel society in the 17th and then broadened in the 18th century. So coffee houses were to some degree like taverns, but they focused on the genteel element of the town. So the sense was that you went to the coffee house to be sort of removed from everyday society, and you might carry on business there, drink coffee, chocolate, or tea. You've probably read Boswell's diary, in which he talks about going with Dr. Johnson to the coffee house, and he says he prefers the food at the London coffee house.
I should think if you're going to do business, coffee, tea, and chocolate would be safer beverages than scotch and whatever passed for the local libation. I mean,
I'm sure that's true, although alcohol has greased the wheels of business for centuries as well.
I was interested that people would go to the coffee house not for a quick cup of whatever it was they were going to have, but to hang out with their elite buddies.
Mm-hmm. So that's certainly the sense that you get from Fauquier's characterization and from English diarists.
It was not a place where women went, if I have read it correctly.
That's right. You might think that it would be more acceptable than a rowdy tavern, but in fact it was very segregated in terms of gender, at least for people who were patrons. Women might work in the coffee house, but generally wouldn't go there for refreshments.
You know a lot about Charlton Coffee House because apparently people kept a lot of records of going to the coffee house and what they discussed there.
Well, there are a number of diary references, but not very explicit about which coffee house and not descriptive of this one. William Byrd talks about going to the coffee house in his great diary, but that's an earlier coffee house. Much of what we know about this one comes from archaeological remains and from the fragments in the Victorian house. The archaeology is actually very interesting in terms of artifacts. A substantial fragment of what we think is an 18th century Cherokee pipe was found. Several human finger bones that seem to have been wired together to be a display as part of a display skeleton. Crucibles with remains of silver and gold that suggest that some sort of testing, assaying of gold and silver and other metals was done on the site. So even archaeologically, there's some sense of a kind of rarefied activity that took place in those rooms behind the porch.
When will guests at Colonial Williamsburg be able to stop by and have a cup of chocolate?
Well, we intend to begin laying brick this fall, and we're already working on the frame, hewing timbers, sawing and hewing timbers of the frame and producing shingles. So we hope that the coffee house is essentially in place by the end of 2009.
That's Colonial Williamsburg, past and present this time. Let us know how you like this week's show. Leave your feedback at www.history.org/podcasts. Check back often. We'll post more for you to download and hear.